You're listening to Let's Talk, a bi-weekly supplement to our regular podcast, Because You Watched, where we talk movies, films, and cinema, or whatever we're obsessed with at the moment. As always, I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
Francesco, let's talk.
You okay through there?
Don't you ever feel like tired and down and feels like your bones don't work, like you're sinking?
We're here to have a good time, eh? You know, I want you to know that you can talk to me about anything as you get older, you know?
Wish we could have stayed for longer.
Me too.
Today, we are going to be talking about Charlotte Wells' 2022 debut feature film, After Sun. Sophie reflects on the shared joy and private melancholy of a holiday she took with her father Callum 20 years earlier. Memories, real and imagined, fill the gaps between footage as she tries to reconcile the father she knew with the man she didn't.
Okay, do you think that synopsis accurately frames the film?
I think so, without spoiling too much, yeah. It gives a hint that there's a sort of darkness at the center of the film.
Yeah, but doesn't really say what kind of darkness it is, which is good because you should watch this film blind.
Yeah, I mean, do you think it should? Do you think that would get more people to watch it? Do you think that it's promising people a different sort of film to the film they ultimately get?
Well, I think what was interesting about watching this film was not knowing what to expect.
Interesting.
And seeing that there's something brooding in the background. Kind of waiting for things to explode in a way that, without spoiling it, they really don't ever. Like, there's no climax to this film. It's just the whole thing, in retrospect, turns out to be a slow burn of emotion.
Yeah, I mean, as much as there is a climax, and I think once we pass sort of the spoiler barrier, which will probably be about 15 minutes, maybe less, we can get into it a bit more, but as much as there is one, it's really quite understated and quite normal.
Yeah, and there is a climax of emotional payoff to a lot of breadcrumbs that have been laid out throughout the film. But let's, you know, give a bit of a more detailed background to this film. It's, as the synopsis suggests, a woman going through a holiday with her father. It's basically her trying, as an adult, to piece together a significant moment in time that she spent with her father back in the past, presumably to kind of retroactively make sense of something that happened. But the way that it's framed is so individualized and so subjective that it intersperses mini DV footage that she took with this very subjectivized gaze of an 11-year-old. And it's such an interesting point of view because you're simultaneously viewing this through the POV of a child, but also as an adult who's literally reviewing that footage and thinking about or judging the action of this child, you know, with a certain benefit of hindsight. I don't know, I feel like it's such a unique point of view that I haven't seen done in the same way in any other film.
Yeah, I mean, it's worth mentioning again, this is Charlotte Wells' first feature, and I think part of what she set out to do, at least in interviews that I've seen her do, is really subvert that sort of arc that you'd expect from a film like this. She talks about how she was pushed at one point to make it so that they open up as the film goes on, whereas the opposite happens. They start off very close, and it's the tension that comes later and is ultimately never really resolved. And I think that it's constantly trying to forge its own path and tell not necessarily a real story, because I don't think that is a particularly interesting motive for making this sort of film, but telling a story that is true to these characters.
Yeah, and that is incredibly relatable in a way that doesn't feel cheap or obvious.
No, I absolutely agree. There's nothing about this film that feels cheap or obvious, or I'd add exploitative.
Oh, absolutely. Like, I would say that despite being a film that does focus on the mundane and the, in a way, banal of the day-to-day lives of these two people on holiday, it manages not to feel banal. Like, its mundanity is actually almost a heightening of the little things that when you're living them, you wouldn't normally notice. But when thinking back on them, they assume a completely different aspect.
We talked in this podcast, not as its own episode, but we did talk on our BFI episode about Jean Dormain.
Mm.
And I think there's something interesting there as a counterpoint. Not that I think this film is similar, but that is a film that very intentionally tries to make the banal cinematic and is trying to make art out of the banal. I don't think this is trying to do the same, even though it is something without a traditionally satisfying narrative.
Mm.
And a lot of the things they do is quite normal.
Yeah.
So I think there is a distinction there, because you talked about banality. I don't want people to listen to this and think that it's going to be intentionally banal for its own sake, or even extremely banal, which I don't think it is.
Oh no, absolutely. It's just, I think it's more a matter of, if you take the individual events that are portrayed in the film, maybe none of them stand out as, you know, some big dramatic moment. But all together, they create this narrative that is so emotionally potent. I also think that Chantal Akerman is a really good comparison. Maybe not Jean Dormain specifically, some of the other films that she made.
Like what?
Well, let's save that for the end when we recommend our alternates, because I was actually thinking about a Chantal Akerman film as mine. But Jean Dormain does this similar thing where the actions portrayed are banal to an extreme that After Sun never reaches. But, you know, the protagonist who's going through the motions, as it were, is, you know, there's something bubbling underneath inside her. And I would argue that Jean Dormain has got much more of a climactic ending than this film does.
Yes, but it's all reserved for the ending.
Yeah, absolutely.
Whereas this, it follows the ebbs and flows of life almost more faithfully than something that is really prioritizing the mundane over the actual things that, you know, because life isn't all mundane. Life does have its ebbs and flows, does have its exciting moments that feel very true to life, but also stop it from being extremely banal.
But that's because I don't think that this film is just observing everything that the two of them do throughout the day. Just the things that it's observing aren't particularly...
Because it's the things she's remembering.
Well, it's the things that she's choosing to remember and the things that she's going through. So it's already a selective memory. Like, we're already being shown moments that, for one reason or another, have a deep importance for her. But maybe we don't understand their importance until the end and then retroactively think back on it.
Well, let's put a pin in that for after we get to the spoilers section. Mm-hmm. It's worth also talking, while we're not at risk of spoiling the film, if just the two central performances are wonderful in this film.
Oh, yeah.
I think Paul Mescal and Frankie Corio are both wonderful. Frankie Corio is very believable and never falls into the... I don't want to be rude about child actors, but there is an energy that you might be familiar with, you might like, you might dislike, that very much isn't there.
Mm-hmm.
It feels like the thing that professional actors work their whole careers to be able to do and make it look effortless. There's something about the way that Frankie Corio is able to play Sophie so naturally and so ungratingly that, I don't know, I think it's a really wonderful find by Charlotte Wells and whoever else was casting the film, that she is so good. And Paul Mescal, obviously, he's nominated for an Oscar for this film. He won't win, but he was very good.
Yeah, and like, I think Frankie Corio's performance definitely benefits also from, one, a screenplay that writes a child character believably, but also, I'm assuming, like, really good direction, as well as her amazing talent. Like, it's a combination of things that just works.
Yeah, I mean, it's a combination of three things, you're absolutely right. But at the same time, I think there is a degree of improvisation in these films and some stuff that was sort of filmed ad hoc. I can't go into detail about which they were, because I'm not entirely sure.
Mm-hmm.
But I think there was a real environment of, if they wanted to do something, they could just do it and get the footage and they'd use it or not use it.
Yeah, because it's not a three-act structure where every scene has its own place in the puzzle.
No, the characters are given so much space and the actors, therefore, are given a lot of space to develop and, you know, bring these people to life.
Absolutely.
And it is so tightly focused on two characters. I know there are other characters in it, but no one that gets anywhere near the entire world is centered on the experience this girl has with her father.
Yeah, if we're shown other characters, is for their interactions with the protagonists to show us something about the protagonists.
Yeah, which is, you know, fairly normal.
Yeah.
But the point is, it is so disciplined in its tightness and focus on the characters. So if they're talking to other tourists, if they're talking to shopkeepers, characters. It's very rare that those characters have like a supporting actor moment that at all takes away from the very tight focus that we have.
But also, they never feel fake despite that. They don't feel like they're just there to advance the main plot. They still feel like real characters inhabiting a real world. It's just that we don't need to get into their interiority in order to, you know, understand
well,
the film.
Well, it's like the Mos Eisley cantina thing in Star Wars.
Oh, yeah.
It's the... Do you know what I'm talking about? Or do you want me to explain? I'll explain,
well, explain it for Mike, yeah.
I think I might be the first person ever to compare this to Star Wars. But what I've always thought was one of the great achievements of the first Star Wars film is that when they go into Mos Eisley Cantina, you have all these fascinating character designs that all feel like each section and corner of this room has its own story and its own life and its own energy, but at the same time is never taking away from the central plot.
Yeah, we don't go off into a subplot to find out about Glapshitter's life while we're focusing on Han Solo.
Deep cut, I like it. But the point being, it's a fully realised world, but the realisation of the world never comes at the expense of the focus.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I think it's a really difficult tightrope to walk, and like Star Wars, After Sun manages it, in my opinion.
Mm-hmm.
So there you have it, After Sun and Star Wars, very similar films.
Oh, well, there's not much more I'd like to say without spoiling, I don't know about you.
I would just like to say the setting is really lovely.
Well, I'll ask you a question.
They're in Turkey. It's like just some of the shots of the environment and the places they go. It's places that you would go on a holiday, but it was very, very nice to see. It's nothing particularly deep. It was just a nice feeling.
Well, you know, there's the landscape shots, but there's also like so much of the cinematography is so interested in these people and their psyche and so like intimate and close. There's a nice contrast between the suffocatingly intimate and the like vertigo-inducing openness that she like really orchestrates very well. One question I would ask is, how does this rank in terms of like your film of the year 2022? Because I know it's my film of the year 2022.
At this point, I have 5 films on my letterbox that I've given 5 stars to, and they are Everything Everywhere All at Once, RRR, Banshees of Inisherin, Babylon, and After Sun.
Mm.
So it's definitely up there in my favourite films of the year. Whether it's my favourite film of the year is entirely arbitrary in my opinion, because they're all good enough that they can do everything for me at the appropriate time.
Yeah, just mentioning this because next week, actually, after this episode comes out, we're going to be hosting, or we're going to be releasing a recording of our own 2022 awards, where we asked all former guests on the podcast and other confidants of us to nominate different films for Best Picture and other categories, and whichever film gets the most nomination wins. And it's no spoilers, we haven't done counting yet, but there was certainly a moment whilst I was counting the first nominations where After Sun didn't get as many votes as some of the others because not as many people had seen it, but it was certainly, and I'm pretty sure it's still going to be by the time we're done voting, a top contender just because every person who voted for it was naming it as their number one film of the year. Fewer people have seen it, but it was able to contend with some of the bigger releases just because of how much the people who had seen it loved it.
It's a bit like Babylon in that not everyone's seen it, but everyone who's seen it really likes it.
So this film is like Star Wars and Babylon, is that?
It is a perfect mix between those two very subtle slice of life realist features. But yeah, like we were saying, people enjoy this film a lot. People who have seen it tend to really like it and tell more people to see it. All of high-profile fans, David Ehrlich of IndieWire, who does quite a famous top 25 films of the year, he put it as number one. Yeah, and it beat Tar, which was the second choice, which I think is a real insult to Lydia.
Would Lydia Tar like this movie?
No.
No.
I don't think Lydia Tar watches movies she hasn't done the compositions for.
Ah, that makes sense. Well, should Lydia Tar have done the score for After Sun?
I don't think they could afford her. And plus, like, I know that we're both big Lydia Tar defenders, but at the same time, I think it helps this movie in the long term that it's not dragged down by that sort of scandal.
Yeah, it's not associated to her, right?
Yeah, and not that, like, you know, cancel culture's real, blah, blah, blah.
Well, there's licensed songs by, you know, Queen, David Bowie.
Do you think that Lydia Tarr would be better than Queen and David Bowie combined? Could she beat Freddie Mercury and David Bowie in a fight?
She probably could beat David Bowie because he was quite skinny. Freddie Mercury...
He was skinny but tall.
Yeah. Nita Tarr is tall as well. What I would say is that she wouldn't be as good at orchestra as the two of them, but they wouldn't be as good orchestra conductors as she is. So who's the real winner here?
That's true, and neither of them ever got the EGOT.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Just saying.
Take that.
Her and Viola Davis.
Freddie Mercury. Who's cancelled now? All right, so we're going to enter into a spoiler section. If you haven't seen the film and...
Fuck off.
Yeah, stop now, go watch it. Wipe away your tears and then come back to listen to some more thoughts.
I'm going to get another beer.
Can hear the clanking, clank, clank.
Did me saying that get picked up on mic?
Absolutely got picked up on mic.
Hello, I'm back.
We're back.
We're back.
So, here's a question.
Sorry. Just hit the beer on the thing like it was a ship.
So, here's a question for you in the spoiler section.
Go on.
How much did you cry in Measures of Liters?
Okay, I didn't cry in the cinema. And you know that I cry a lot in the cinema.
Mm-hmm.
I cried on the way home.
Mm.
I cried on the bus.
Yeah.
I think that's my Letterboxd review, that it's the sort of film that doesn't really devastate you in the moment. It devastates you on your way home.
I had a similar feeling of, like, my reaction right after watching the film, and for the moments and hours after, was one of, like, stunned silence and reflection. When I was more separated from watching it, I went on YouTube and rewatched the Under Pressure scene and just wept.
Really?
Like, yeah, just waterworks. But not in the moment, which I think it's kind of... It's what the film is trying to do, right? It's about piecing together things you've experienced in the past, but you couldn't really make sense of until you had the conclusion of it or the full picture.
How old do you think he is when he becomes a father? My read was like after school, but very shortly after school.
Well, she's 11 and he's turned 30.
Yes,
he's turning 30 19. During the holiday, so 18, 19.
So yeah, it's not like a, you know, tragic teenage parent kind of thing, even though 19 is technically still a teenager. It's just a very young parent.
Yeah.
And the way they deal with it is really clever. Like, they talk about it a bit, but the scene where it really sort of hits you that, oh, this is a thing that isn't crazy, but it's a thing they have to explain, which is something that's sort of more weird. When someone says, oh, your sister.
Oh, yeah.
And yes, oh no, I'm her father. And like, they understand from him saying that what's going on, but it's the fact that every time they're out together, he will have to make a similar explanation.
Mm-hmm. And there's also that scene that is actually repeated twice. We see the very beginning of it, near the beginning of the film, and then we see the full scene. It's a DV camera shot, POV from the child, on the day of his birthday, where she's asking him, you know, like a child would, you know, his thoughts about turning 30, and it's kind of brushing her off. And then when we see the full extent of that conversation later on, like, he's getting really miffed and asking her to turn off the camera, like, I don't want to think about this, I don't want to talk about this, and he's almost like getting, like, uncharacteristically aggressive towards her.
Yeah, their relationship and his temperament is really interesting to me, because he's definitely not an abusive parent.
No.
But he is someone that has the sort of anger that you would associate with being a parent, particularly being a father of a child that's that age. I think the fact that he is so young while having a child that age, it makes his anger and his, you know, his reactions to things, and yes, his reactions are often very out of proportion, as I'm sure we'll talk about. But seeing it from such a young face, I don't know, there was something that really allowed you to sort of see the reaction in isolation rather than falling into the coding of, oh, it's a father being angry at his daughter.
Well, I think a lot of his reactions, like, clearly watching it as adults, stem from the anger that he feels against himself, his self-hatred, which turns into self-obsession and makes him not realize how he comes across to his daughter, who, like, at this age, she doesn't know that he's having these feelings about himself, and probably takes this behavior as something that she's at fault for, or that he's angry at her for something.
Especially at that time, where even among adults, no one was talking about, you know, mental health or depression or anything like that.
I mean, with 30-year-old men, I feel like even nowadays we're lagging way behind in terms of having them, like, open up.
I mean, we're both closer to 30 than we are 20, and I think that we should stop talking quite so much about our mental health on podcasts.
Yeah, that's the issue. We do it in front of a mic. That's our substitute for therapy.
So, I don't want to go through it chronologically, but if you had to pick not a scene, but sort of an act or a sequence of the film that really spoke to you, either where you are now or where you were when you were Sophie's age? What do you think it would be?
There's a scene that... So I would say, okay, if we're talking about an emotional climax of the film, in a way is that whole sequence where he leaves her alone at night, goes off, you know, to mull over himself, and she ends up having a night out and being locked out of the room. The scene before that, what causes that is this sequence where they are at this theater show in the resort.
It's a
karaoke show, yeah. And she's trying to like pull him to like go down and sing for her and sing with her. And we know he's a good singer. We saw him sing before, but he refuses to do so. So she gets on stage. She sings how in a way that feels like almost purposely off key and disengaged. And she's, you know.
Do you mean on the part of the character or on the part of the actor?
On the part of the character.
That she's doing that to sort of show him, look how comfortable I am. I don't care if I'm bad at singing.
Yeah, exactly. But also like she seems like, I don't know. She's also a child. It's kind of hard to gauge like intent in this situations, but she's not looking at him, she's just looking at the words on the screen, but she's very emotionless. It feels like she's like almost so pissed at him that she's just gonna do this in a very like brusque, half-arsed way, just to show him that she can do it, as you said. And then she goes back to sit down, and it's this whole like hyper-aggressive interaction where the two of them should just talk to each other, but it's clearly the responsibility of the dad to be talking to his daughter. Like, it's not the responsibility of the daughter for reacting like a child.
And to be the adult.
And to be the, yeah, literally.
But it is really interesting that, again, to go back to his age, he is old enough at 30 to be a father.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you're old enough for any age as long as it's consensual, but the point is that it's normal to be a father at 30. But when you have an 11-year-old, you're more likely late 30s or early 40s. And the emotional complexities that arise from having an older child, you grow to meet as you get older as well.
Yeah, but also the implication with this character, with Callum, is that he had an abusive childhood, so we don't know how much of an actual childhood and adolescence he had for himself. And when he entered young adulthood, when he maybe should have at the time to like break away from his family background, find a life of his own, find a career, etc., he had a small child, so he probably couldn't afford to do all of that, and now he's finding himself in between jobs and broke, which is another thing I wanted to bring up about the sequence, that after she comes back and sits back down with him in the audience, he kind of tries to make things easier by promising her, I don't remember what exactly, like promising to get her something or to get her somewhere, and she bites back by saying, stop promising me things that I know you can't afford.
Which is a devastating thing to hear as a parent.
Exactly, but it summarizes their dynamic so well that she as a child doesn't know that she's hitting a soft spot. She's probably just hitting a fact in her mind.
No, I think she knows she's hitting a sore spot, but I don't think she knows how deep it goes.
Oh, well, that too. But because, once again, this is her as an adult thinking back on that memory, think of the way that it will have on you to remember you said something like that a few days before your dad, presumably, you know, passed away. And that's one of the last interactions that they had. Like, it's so devastating from both ends.
Should we just get into the ending of the film? Or, like, the reveal of the film?
Well, yeah. Obviously, if you've seen the film, there's no content warnings to be made. You know, it deals with depression and suicide, but...
Or implied suicide.
Implied. Again, you mentioned how responsible and non-exploitative it is. Like, nothing is actually shown, but everything is felt, which I think is the best way of doing it. Mm.
I don't think that line makes sense unless she is trying to cause pain. I just don't think she knows why it causes pain.
Mm.
She knows it's a sore spot, but she doesn't know how emasculating it is for that character to be told by his daughter that he is unable to support his family.
Yeah, and there are so many scenes before this that establishes, you know, insecurity and his relationship to his finances. There's, you know, when she loses the swimming goggles.
I was going to say, that's my favourite sequence, yeah. Is the bit on the boat where you don't see much of their conversation. As in, you hear it all, but you don't see it.
Mm.
That's like, you hear them fighting because she's lost her goggles, and then he goes in. But either way, there's something just about that scene that is a great precursor to the scene that you mentioned.
Yeah.
But I think the way that it's shot and the way that it allows... I love it when a filmmaker allows characters a degree of privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense? That,
no, absolutely. Especially in a film that is so, like, as we said, intimate.
Yeah, it's private.
Yeah.
And it's about I don't want to get into whether this film is autobiographical, because it's not really my business, and I don't think that a film should be judged on that. I know there are elements of it that are taken from the Charlotte Wells' own life and her own relationship with her father, but more to the point, I think that it's not about Charlotte Wells' relationship to her father, it's about Sophie's relationship to her father.
Mm-hmm.
And that is more than enough for this film to work. And I think almost getting bogged down into how related this is to the director's own personal life, I think it distracts from just how good the film is.
Exactly. And like, even if she didn't go through the same exact experiences, like, she clearly has a talent for telling these stories, or this particular story.
Well, we don't know if she's telling these stories because she's only made one film.
Yeah, yeah. But like, this particular story, like, she told it, you know, flawlessly, regardless of whether she experienced it herself.
I totally agree. I think that this is... Actually, I haven't mentioned it. It's produced by Barry Jenkins.
Oh, there you go.
So we're not the only ones that think that Charlotte Wells knows how to spin a yarn.
But no, that scene on the boat, there's also a line that I completely... Like, I didn't even register it when I first saw the film. It's only when I went back and read the synopsis that highlighted that line, that I thought back on it. But when he's speaking to the diving instructor, and the diving instructor asks him what his plans are or something, and he says, oh, I don't see myself making it to 40, as a joke. And the fact that I didn't even register that line as being significant when I saw it, to the point where I forgot it, speaks volumes to how depression very often manifests itself, especially in its more like mundane day-to-day stages, where it can be like very often a throwaway line or a quote-unquote joke that betrays a more serious feeling. I don't know, this film is so good.
It's a very good film. So, with that in mind, which Marvel property do you think Charlotte Wells should direct as her next film?
Eternals 2. This is the list of films that Aftersun is like Star Wars, Babylon, and Eternals.
Eternals 2, specifically.
Yeah. Why did you ask this question?
No, I was just... because like a new filmmaker turns up.
Oh, I
hope she gets to make a mid-budget movie next, and then a big-budget movie, rather than getting immediately swept up into an anonymous, Disneyfied film. The only person who can make that work is Ryan Coogler.
Well, you know, she's been compared a lot, and for good reason, to Lynn Ramsey.
Okay, I wanted to get onto this.
Yeah, and Lynn Ramsey went from making, you know, low-budget Scottish films to making mid-budget American films with Tilda Swinton and Joaquin Phoenix, which are still really good, and they're not, you know, huge studio productions. So I think that's the direction that Charlotte Wells, I hope, goes in. Although I'd love her to keep making, like, minimal-budget Scottish films, because that's my niche. I also want her to, you know...
Specifically Scottish films. That's your niche.
If she goes, like, you know, if she...
If she gets to Cumbria, she's done.
Nah, she's out. But, you know, I also want her to be able to afford a living, and you know, a comfortable living.
But also, she deserves to make as big a film as she wants, as long as it's not swept up in the horrible machine.
Well,
she deserves to make a big budget movie that will lose a load of money.
Oh, yeah. That's what we all deserve.
Like Babylon.
Mm-hmm. So what were you looking up earlier?
So I was on my phone, because I don't know if it's because it felt inevitable or because I'd heard it and then forgotten about it, but I was curious to what the betting odds were on Paul Mescal becoming the next James Bond.
Okay.
And they're not great on, but he's in the conversation, except the Irish Mirror lists him, I think, on Boyle Bets. Ladbrokes has him moving up from 25 to 1 to 14 to 1.
Okay.
So that's not nothing.
Well, but I just looked it up. Paul Mescal is your age.
Yeah, I know. He's more successful.
I know, but
I'm 26.
I didn't mean to, like...
he's your age. You're older than me.
No, he was born in 96.
Yeah, but I'm born late 96.
All right, whatever. You're right. He was born 2nd of February 96. Anyway, he's 27. Recently turned 27, by the way. Happy birthday, Paul.
Happy birthday, Paul. Come on the show.
He's too young to play...
We'll bump Fion.
He's too young to play James Bond.
I think Paul Mescal could pull that off.
I think he could, but that's enough of James Bond. Aftersun.
We're going to keep all that in.
I'm going to force you to cut half of that. Not all of that, half of that.
So I guess my question for you before we finish is, you were the one who said, I want to do a Let's Talk on Aftersun.
Mm-hmm.
And I just wonder if you could explain on Mike why you felt so strongly that this is the film that you wanted to talk about in such, you know, loving terms.
Well, because in a way, we're still figuring out what Let's Talk is, you know, mostly because it's not really anything. It's just us talking about what we want to talk about. But I kind of want it to be something that's kind of relevant to, you know, contemporary, you know, what's going on, what's happening right now, who's doing the thing. And
Angela Bassett
is doing the thing. And recently the BAFTAs happened, and I kind of thought, okay, we could do a Let's Talk on that. But then we were like, no, because we're going to do one on the Oscars.
And where we'll mention the BAFTAs.
Yeah, we did our Oscars prediction.
I just didn't want to talk that much about All Quiet on the Western Front, even though I think it's fine.
Yeah, exactly. And like, the BAFTAs were like 2 weeks ago from the time of recording that, so who cares about those anymore? But bar, then I was like, okay, our podcast is about recommending films that most people haven't seen. So how about we take a film that has gotten some award buzz, has won a BAFTA for Best British Debut, but, I mean, at least in my opinion, I think in both of our opinion, is actually a better film than most of the stuff that was nominated for the BAFTA award. Best Film BAFTA award. And
yeah.
And also something that I wanted to talk about, and I don't know if we're going to have a chance to have it as a title pick. Could be an alternate for some films in the future, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. And I wonder if it will actually grow in acclaim. You know, hopefully we'll be doing this show for a very long time.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we'll be able to see the cultural legacy of Let's Talk.
Of After Sun as well. So, Charlie, as we often do in these episodes, to maintain the spirit of Because You Watched, if After Sun was a title pick, what will be your alternate?
Well, I mean, I'd love to do a regular episode on this film if it, you know, has a staying power, which I think it does have the potential for. But I'm interested to see what you think of an alternate, just because I'm having a bit of trouble thinking of one.
Well, I actually got a bunch. I mentioned earlier in the episode how I was thinking of Chantal Akerman, particularly her latest film, No Home Movie, is an observational documentary that she shot on a small digital camera where she explores a relationship with her mother, who at the time of shooting was slowly deteriorating with dementia and close to dying. She also made another film about her relationship with her mother, News from Home, back in the 70s. And I think that would be my chief pick. Other things I was thinking about are the work of Kirsten Johnson, a American documentarian who made Camera Person and Dick Johnson is Dead.
Oh, I love Dick Johnson is Dead.
Oh, you've seen it.
It's
yeah.
great.
And
it's really
again,
interesting.
Once again, it's about a daughter's relationship with her dying father. Also about Alzheimer's. After Sun isn't about Alzheimer's, as you mentioned, but all the films that I mentioned are about Alzheimer's, but they all have documentary elements specifically, which I think is what links them to After Sun.
I think for my choice, it is a film by a director we have covered on the podcast, a director of one of our picks on our Brokeback Mountain episode, on same Andrew Haig, who directed Weekend.
Okay.
He directed another film, which I absolutely love, called 45 Years.
Okay.
Starring Tom Courtney and Charlotte Rampling.
Interesting. Well, I adored Weekend, so I'm definitely gonna check this out.
Yeah, it's a wonderful film. On the face of it, it's not that similar to After Sun. If I just tell you the synopsis, it's the 45th wedding anniversary of a childless married couple, and they find the body of the husband's ex-girlfriend from a holiday he took with her before he met his wife. And it's almost like the memories are frozen in time.
Mm.
And you can see the parallels with that and After Sun. It's the ways that we reckon with the past and reckon with relationships with the people who've left us.
Interesting. So it's almost like my picks were going more for the style of After Sun. Yours is going more for the themes of memory and recollection,
yeah.
Which is the marriage of using a certain type of documentary technology to explore the relationship with one's parent, with the caveat that in After Sun, it's fictional, done in a documentary or home video style.
Yeah, I think you'd really enjoy 45 Years.
Oh, I mean, if it's anything like Weekend, I'd absolutely love it. Okay.
So should we talk availability? Then we can keep talking about other stuff if you
absolutely.
Want. Sorry, I got distracted because our sponsor is
streaming this,
so you can stream this on Mubi, you can rent it on Amazon, Apple TV, Curzon Home Cinema and Sky Store, as well as
Rakuten TV,
the best streaming service in the world.
Only shows good films.
Only shows good films.
Shows every film that is good.
Does it show Citizen Kane?
Don't look that up. If it doesn't, it means that Citizen Kane is not a good film. And that's a final word on that.
Rakuten has spoken. You can buy it on all those channels except for Curzon Home Cinema.
Mm-hmm. It does show
You can
Citizen
buy
Kane.
It on Rakuten TV, but you can't rent it.
All right. But
so if you're just a renter, then sorry, grow up.
They'll show Citizen Kane, but you have to fucking commit to it.
Commit to the Kane.
Yeah. I feel like we're underselling just how emotionally crushing this film is, but I feel like the how unserious
I've
we're getting.
I've had a weird day.
Yeah, and it's just symptomatic of the fact that it's so emotional and so crushing that getting into too much of that might be a bit too hard for what is normally a lighthearted podcast, and two very tired people who are just trying to relax for a bit.
Yeah, I'm still recovering from a heavy weekend, not doing anything cool, of going to an all-nighter at a cinema with some friends of the podcast and getting back home at 9:30 a.m. after no sleep, except maybe a few minutes here or there during Amarcord. So I'm still recovering from that.
Because so you went to the Prince Charles cinema all-nighter that was, what, a marathon of like five mystery films?
Yeah. Oh. But they weren't all films about mysteries. But no. The mystery was what the films were. They weren't mystery films.
But that keeps you awake, I feel. Because I've done an all-nighter.
Not if you've seen the films.
True. I've done an all-nighter at the Prince Charles. It was all of Wes Anderson's films. That was years ago.
But did you know which ones they were going to be?
Oh, yeah, it was just his whole filmography to that point. It was like 12 films. It was long.
That was an all-nighter. Did you start during the day?
I think it went on until like 12 Sunday.
When did it start?
I don't remember. It was years ago. Anyway, I slept during the ones that I'd already seen.
Sounds like an absolute nut. Because the thing that I really like about the Prince Charles Mystery Marathon is that they're so different. So, they did The Lady Eve, which is the Preston Sturges film from the 1940s. Then they did The Player, which is the Robert Altman film from the 90s. Then they did Amarcord, which is an Italian film, which is not really what you want to be watching that late at night with subtitles that don't quite... You've got white writing on like a lot of white background.
Oh my god, it was the same when I saw 8.5 at the Prince Charles. I think it's because it was a 35mm copy.
Yeah, I like that. And then it was Buckaroo Banzai, or The Adventures of Buckaroo Banzai in
which
the
I really
dimension.
Want, I'd never heard about before.
Which Francesco would love.
Yeah.
And then finally it was Mad Max Fury Road, which we have covered on the podcast.
Well, two films are covered on the podcast, including Amarcord. Yeah, interesting.
But one title pick.
One title pick, one alternate.
And I really want to do it again, and I really want Francesco to come next time I do it.
Yeah, just stay up all night and fuck up your sleep cycle for cinema.
Yeah, I'm not really selling it to you because I'm so broken right now.
I used to do these things when I was a student and I didn't have a schedule. Now I'm like, oh, do I want to commit to like feeling like shit for 2 days? I don't know. But that was an interesting tangent. We're going to post Charlie. And who were you with?
So I was with former guest, and future guest, Peter McNamara, our chief Skerrit correspondent, Will Smith, and future guest, Fionn Kreber.
So we're going to post their reactions to all of those films. Probably on Twitter or on social media.
And if we like the way that it turns out, maybe on the feed. But
yeah, absolutely.
Just because it's a nice 10-minute thing you could enjoy listening to.
Yeah, for sure. But
Francesco doesn't want me to.
Well, just if you want to listen to it, that's going to excuse us. I need to follow our social media.
That's true. We are on Twitter at BCU Watch Pod and on Instagram at BCU Watch Podcast. Thank you, Molecule, for our artwork. Thank you, Jade Corbett, for producing. Thank you, Francesco.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.
Subscribe.